Turkey, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! So it is that a brand new broadcast week begins. This is the 18th day of April, 2016. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That is where you go if you want to jump into the chat room where folks are filing in for More in Monday even now. Good evening to Anatole and Jug of Punch and Labor Man, all capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third-stage guild navigator, has folded space on a lovely Northern California spring afternoon to become Man Cave. Yes, yes, indeed. And, of course, this is a listener-supported effort, and program note, I'm going to be gone the biggest part of next week, if not the entirety of next week. I've got a meeting I have to attend down Atlanta way, and consequently we're going to try to double up on the fundraising this week. That means that the usual $200 we try to raise every evening has become four. And with that in mind, I'm proud to announce that I had a note from Chris in Germany who said that she will happily match the first $100 that comes in. So that'll take care of half of it. Because if you give 10, she adds 10. If you give 20, she adds 20. Up to the first 100 bucks, which will mean 200. And then we'll only have 10 at 20, 20 at 10, 1 at 200, 2 at 100, 4 at 50, 8 at 25, 16 at 12 and a half, and 32 at 6 and a quarter to go from there. Okie dokie. The PayPal interface is, of course, over at headonradionetwork.com. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Yes. And, PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. And there you will find some fields to fill out, at which point in time you can leave out what it is you do for Perry Mason down at the law offices in downtown Los Angeles. Yes. And just get to the next page. Get to the next screen there, so that's where you make all your decisions. If you prefer to operate by virtue of the United States Mail Service, the USPS, checks and money orders should be sent to The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEY, WV 25801. 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318. Get all of that right, because remember, that's a UPS store where we share a box with the Klan. And we say checks and money orders made payable to The Horn so that those dirty, thieving, foul, vulgar, rotten, no good, racist, bigoted, sick freaks can't get their hands on your money. Yes, yes, indeed. Now, it's about 4 minutes past the hour, and of course, ordinary Mondays here are More in Monday. But tomorrow's kind of special, so that makes tonight kind of special. Tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern is the season finale to Outsiders. And, you know, I mentioned this program before it started, and many of us have quickly become hopelessly hooked on this program. And there's a lot of questions to be answered tomorrow night, or maybe left hanging. I don't know. I was tickled to find out that the program has been picked up for a second season. And so this evening, here in a matter of just a very few moments, I'm going to be joined by Peter Mattei. Peter Mattei is the creator of Outsiders. It was his vision that brought this this Appalachian dystopia, and we'll find out if that's an appropriate word, to life. We'll find out just where it all came from. It's not every day you get to have a sit-down conversation with the creator of a television program, so I imagine there's a lot of stuff that we can garner in this discussion. So I'm looking forward to it a great deal, and I'm really kind of on the edge of my seat about what we're going to find out tomorrow evening, and how much is going to be answered and how much is going to be left hanging. It's one of the reasons that I find the program so compelling is that nothing in the program is easy. It is in many ways true to especially on the community side of things. It's especially true to what happens here in what we refer to quite often as the sacrifice zone. So that's coming up in a matter of a couple of minutes. They're getting ready to begin shooting on season two. And I guess we'll have a lot better sense after tomorrow night as to where we can expect that to go. Yeah. Here in about quick as the phone rings, really. We'll have that. We'll be having that conversation, of course. After that, your discussion, your conversation. If you've got any questions along the way. For Peter Mattei, you can email them to me at bobkincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, bobkincaid@gmail.com. And we'll try to work them right in there. Okay? Sound good? Good. So that's the plan in fairly short order. Alrighty then. And then as well, we've got stuff to deal with, in the usual vein of, Moran Monday coming up as well. God almighty, I feel like I've been collecting them since about 9:01 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Friday. Huh! Yeah, plenty. As in lots. As in a surfeit of information. Well, let's see what we got going on here. Okay. Marty, you didn't attach the photo. Yeah, oh well. I tried to make sure that we got through all of the usual beginning of the program stuff so that we wouldn't be hurried when the call came in. And I think I did too good a job. But I want to extend thanks to Brandon. Brandon got us started. Brandon out of Oregon got us started this evening on fundraising, and thanks to Chris overnight as well. So that actually means we've only got $325 to go, which is pretty important. Stand by. As promised, we have Peter Mattei, creator of Outsiders. Is that you, Peter?
Yes, sir.
I'm so awfully glad to have you on the program this evening. As we discussed previously, the group of us, our little community congregation, have become very, very, very much enraptured by the doings of the Farrell clan and the folks down in town. Tell me, if you don't mind, Peter, I've already told people a little bit of biographical information about who you are prior to your ringing in. Tell us a little bit about the creative process that led to the creation of this. And is it fair to call it a dystopia?
I would say it's a, yeah, I say that's partly fair, but it's a little bit of a utopia, being threatened. You know, first of all, it's great to be here on your show, and, I'm really happy and honored to be, talking to you and calling in. In terms of how this thing came about, you know, it was sort of a bunch of different ideas that were cooking around in my head for quite a while. And I had sold a few TV pilots to different networks over the years, where, you know, I'd come up with an idea for a cop show or a medical show or whatever, and I'd go out to LA and take meetings and pitch the ideas. And I had sold a bunch of them, and then you write the scripts and then nothing ever happens to them. And this particular idea, I knew it was just too weird for me to actually pitch it. And so I just kind of didn't do anything with it, and it stayed in my head, in some version or another for a couple of years. And then I finally just decided to go and write it and get it out of my system. You know, the genesis of it was a lot of different things. I mean, I had read an article about a group of people that was like what they call a triracial isolate community living on a hill in New Jersey, and I thought that was really interesting premise for something or other. And I thought, well, if you were going to do a show about a group of people living on a hill that, you know, live outside of our rules and kind of have their own way of life and everything else, you might as well push the boundaries of that a little bit and just make it kind of a fantasy. And then I thought, well, in order for it to really be a show, their way of life would have to be threatened by somebody or something. And I had various ideas as to what that could be, and I had known some people in Brooklyn, where I used to live, who were involved in the whole mountaintop removal activism thing in West Virginia mostly, and so I knew a little bit about it, and so I did some more research and realized that would be kind of the perfect threat to this mountain, and that's why I decided to set the show in Appalachia. I mean, it's set in Kentucky, but it's set in a fictional town in a fictional county, so it's really kind of made up. And I did my research in Boone and Raleigh counties in West Virginia, so. You know, there's a lot of other things too. It was like my experience of living in Brooklyn for 20 years and having it become super expensive and having people come in and basically evicting, you know, everybody that wasn't a millionaire, kind of, I think, fueled some of the energy in the story. And a bunch of other things really, like my interest in American music. I love the idea of having a show that took place in a part of the world where I really love the music, and I'm also a huge fan of folk art and, you know, rural American culture and stuff like that. So it all sort of came together into one thing that I couldn't really let go of. So finally, I just wrote the script.
Well, for starters, Peter, how long was the process? I mean, we sit here and we watch from week to week as viewers, but how long is that process that you just, or all of those things that you just talked about, how long is that in the brewing, if you will?
You know, it can vary, but for me, I kind of stewed on this idea for a year or more, and then I wrote it, and then I didn't really have an agent at the time. I only had a film agent at another agency, and then he left, and I was kind of agentless. And I sent the script around to a few different people over a period of about a year, and they all told me the same thing, which was that they liked it, but it was just too weird. And I finally got it to my old agent, and he loved it and got behind it. And And then we got it to some other producers, and then we just started sending it out to different networks, and WGN America really responded to it in the strongest way.
And they've supported it quite well, haven't they?
Absolutely.
I noticed that when it premiered, Outsiders was the highest rated original programming that they had ever aired. Was that not the case?
I believe so. I believe it was. Yeah, and it's done really well for them. So all told, you know, from the time I conceived of it to the time that we started shooting was probably 2.5 years or something like that.
That's amazing. As the creator of the program, then when you sat down to, I mean, obviously when that process whereby you sent it around to the people who said we love it but it's too weird or what, you weren't sending around 13 scripts.
No, just one script. I wrote a pilot script that was about 52 pages long or something like that, and that's what we sent around.
And so then is it during the writing process that you flesh out the details of what, because what amazed me is the level of detail in this, the degree to which we really do get pulled into this into this alternate lifestyle world. I mean, these folks are off the grid, aren't they? Was that a process that happened in the making?
Yes, partly. I mean, a lot of it, you know, I wrote the pilot really fast and didn't think too much about all those details. And then when they greenlit the series, we hired a bunch of writers. And, you know, the way TV is made, so you have a group of writers, you know, five or six or sometimes even many more, and you sit in an office all day and you just kind of talk and shoot the crap about what the show could be and what the stories could be, and you take notes and then you start to do outlines for episodes. So it's really a group collaborative effort. And of course the other people in the room who weren't inside my head would ask me questions. Well, how is it that if these people are totally on top of a mountain and they're off the grid, then how could they, you know, have power for lights and things like that? And so we had to have lots of different discussions. And then when we got into production with the production designer, with the director of the opening episodes and with the actors to answer those questions too. So we slowly sort of came to understand, you know, how they would have generators and how they would have ATVs and how they fueled those ATVs and all those sorts of questions. And I still think there's a lot of things that we haven't even really figured out yet, you know, but,
season two.
Yeah, for season two. And I mean, and part of the process also, you know, is before they even greenlit the series, I wrote what they call, in the business, they call it a show Bible. And, I wrote about a 25 page booklet on who the Farrells were and where they came from and what their sort of mythology is and their religion and if they're magic or don't have magic and how they make their moonshine and, you know, pretty much just put it all on the page so that other people coming to this thing could read it and kind of get a head start, you know?
Well, and I mean, you mentioned the moonshine. Moonshine is a very, very real thing in Appalachia and I guess other parts of the country, but it'll take you places you never thought you were going to go, but I've never seen it go quite where the city folk go on Farrell wine without divulging anything that we don't need to know. It seems like the Farrells, they're accustomed to it. Is that it? And the folks down in the holler aren't.
Well, that's a good question, and I think that's one of the things that we don't necessarily have an answer to. You know, and that's part of the mythology of the show, and it's part of the overall conversation as to whether or not the Farrells have their own brand of of magic, of voodoo. I mean, what I've always said about Farrell wine is, I don't think that they don't put any kind of, you know, they don't lace it with LSD or anything like that. They just make it, and it has different effects on different people if it wants to. It doesn't have to, but it can, you know, and those can vary from as things that are sort of simple and comic to things that are much darker and violent.
And one of the reasons I used the word dystopia at the beginning of our conversation, Peter, is the fact that, I think in many ways you can apply that term not so much to what goes on up on Shay's Mountain, because the Ferrells seem to live by their own code, they live by their own terms, they have interpersonal dynamics that any human culture does. But it's sort of organic and makes sense to them, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
The dystopia kicks in when you meet the folks down in the town, because that ain't Mayberry down there, Peter.
Right. No, I know. I mean, I think that that's just a town that has just seen better days and has really hit some hard times. And so I'm very sympathetic to that, you know, and to the plight of everyday working people in this country. I mean, I think one of the themes in the show is kind of like how we're all bickering and fighting with each other, but we all sort of have the same goals. And the people in Blackburg, you know, they're having a hard time. They've lost a lot of jobs and everything else, and so I really want to be sympathetic to their plight, as well as, you know, obviously to the Ferrells and their wish to hold on to their place.
Absolutely. And looking at Blackburg, being where I am in West Virginia and being familiar with some of these mined out communities, it's hard not to look at Blackburg and see Whitesville, West Virginia. Where there's plywood on storefront windows as if it was preparing for a hurricane, and the economy has just completely imploded upon itself. You mentioned earlier that you had some interaction with activists and stuff here in Appalachia. Did you and that shaped the confrontational dynamic of outsiders. Did the activists sort of play into the idea of the Ferrells, or was it just the confrontation?
I would think that it's more like just the confrontation, and you know, I don't really have any activists characters in the show. Although we're exploring that idea for season two, it was more like they were people that were very open to talking to me and to showing me around, and that was an easy. I had some connections to that community, and that was an easy way for me to kind of get the lay of the land. I spent some time in Whitesville and all those towns around there, Rock Creek and whatever. So yeah, I mean. That's exactly what Blackburg is kind of based on, although it's a little bit bigger than Whitesville, but still.
Yeah. So let me ask you a little bit about the Ferrells' background. I mentioned to you that I was actually there's a fairly, at least for Appalachia, big mall in Charleston, West Virginia, and I was in the Macy's there a while back. And I kind of had to whip my head around real quick because I heard somebody behind me holler, get, get, ya.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, it's catching on, because that's the catch-all call to arms, cry of agreement. But you've also got words like Brennan, and it's not, you know, you don't, in the scripting, you don't salt it in there so much that people wind up confused, but where does that heritage come into the process?
Well, the language that they speak we call old tongue, and I just kind of made it up. I just figured that if these people were really off the grid for a long time, that they might have originally spoken, you know, when they came over here 250 years ago or so, they might have spoken Gaelic, Welsh, you know, Scots. So I thought, well, it would be interesting if they sort of over the years had developed a little bit of a slang, like they dropped it mostly for English, but they still retain some little bits of slang here and there and some words. And so I kind of just made that up and used Google Translate to make up words and stuff like that in the original script. And then as we developed it, you know, and one of the ideas was that we would never subtitle it, so it wouldn't be so much that you would be confused. It wasn't going to be as full on as Game of Thrones, you know, with Dothraki or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And then as we developed it, we sort of like read some stuff about inventing languages and some other things, and then really got into what those actual words would be and made up our own language.
So my guess is that Scots Irish and Welsh and I mean, and those are all is kind of on. It sounds like, because that's a huge, you know, that's a huge part of the colonial settlement period.
Exactly.
The population dynamic of the region. With regard to what I understand the story thus far to be, though, the Ferals have been in conflict with the extraction industries for some time now, have they not?
In my backstory for them, they haven't been. And the reason for that was we said that Shea Mountain was, you know, really big and formidable, and that it just was the kind of the last one that anybody got to. And that there had been in the backstory, like say some 20 years prior to now, 20, 25 years prior to now, there had been one effort to get them off, and it didn't go very well, and some people were hurt, including Big Foster's father was killed in that confrontation, and then also the person that represented whatever the coal company was back then was Sheriff Houghton's dad, and that after this ended, some couple of months later, his father was hit by lightning and killed, and that people in the region associated that with some sort of feral magic, some sort of voodoo from them, that they had those kinds of powers. Of course, you could also argue that he just got hit by lightning. So there's always been a lot of conversation about it, and they never really tried again. And so that this is really the first concerted effort that anybody has done to kick them off the hill.
Okay, well, that makes sense then, because I mean I'd seen the back references to Big Farrell's dad or Big Foster's dad, and to the sheriff's father. There's some flashbacks that go on there, and that's why I wondered if this was, you know, sort of an ancient grudge or if it had a feud quality to it. But what you where in the process was it just a natural thing to because you're highlighting one of the real scourges of this region right now, Peter, and that is the opioid epidemic. How did that come into the creative process?
You mean in terms of Wade Howden's like oxy addiction?
Yeah.
Well, it was just something that I knew was an issue for sure, because you can read about it anywhere. And then when I was in the region, I, you know, talked to people about it and then did a bunch of research about it. And then actually, Thomas Wright, who plays Wade Houghton, he spent about 10 days or 2 weeks in Harlan County, basically not doing anything, just hanging out. And he met with a bunch of law enforcement to get research for his character and stuff like that. And he actually went and visited some hospitals and some clinics and really talked to people about it. So he was really helpful in giving us a lot more information. I mean, it's kind of crazy, the process of making a television show like this, because obviously I'm not from your region, and I'm trying to do as much research as I can, but obviously, you know, not everything's going to be perfect, and so it's, you know, I'm always looking for more, but I'm always very aware of the fact that my knowledge is quite limited, and it's partly just the nature of the beast, you know. I mean, I would love to be shooting the show in Appalachia, but just economically that wasn't really possible.
Well, I mean, I'll be the first to say that if you want to do something in West Virginia other than mine coal, Peter, best look somewhere else to do it. The cast itself is quite a diverse group. You've got an Australian playing I guess in different circumstances we would call her the ingenue.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the sheriff. He's British, is he?
The sheriff is also Australian.
Oh, is he Australian too?
Yes.
Nobody here knows how a TV series happens, how does that come together?
You mean in terms of the casting?
Yeah.
Well, you know, our studio, meaning the people that are financing the project, is Sony Pictures Television, and they have, a whole casting department of people that this is what they do all the time is cast TV shows, and so they're well acquainted with all the agents and everything that's out there. And so the first thing we did was met with them and then start to send the script out to these different agents, and the agents send the script out to their actors that they think might be right for something. And in the case of Thomas, he contacted us from Australia and said, I love this project and I would love to be a part of it. And we got on the phone and, you know, got on the Skype with him actually and talked to him about it a couple times. And then he sent some auditions. He videotaped himself. And based on that, we hired him without actually having met him person to person. Other cast members, we did that as well. Some of them, we just knew their work and we made offers to them. And then others came in to the offices at Sony and we did real auditions with them, putting them through the ringer like, you know, two and three times on auditions. And that's how we built the main characters in the cast.
Well, you've pulled together quite the ensemble. Is it a similar process for coming up with the set design, the costuming, the makeup, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean mostly me and the director Adam Bernstein, who did the first two episodes, as well as our other producers here. We sort of thought about who are the production designers that we really loved and costumes and so on, and we made calls and Adam knew of some different people, and we just kind of interviewed people on phone and sometimes they would send us some of their ideas for how they think the Ferrells would dress, just pulling pictures off the internet. When we, like for costumes, for example, working with Sarah Beers, we I said to her, I think that it's some kind of a crazy mashup of rural Appalachian people today that would be sort of living off the grid a little bit, and a biker gang and a hippie commune from the 70s. And so it's some crazy mashup of that thing. And then she came up with the look that we had. And the same thing for production design. I was like, I didn't want to be true to any one realistic thing. I think we needed to make up our own idea of how their houses might look and how they might build them with a little bit of flair. And we looked at a bunch of pictures of different things and did it that way.
Well, one of the things that has grabbed me is the uniqueness of the costuming, because it merges so well and helps to create the sort of attitude that attends the Ferrell clan. Now we've seen some pretty significant gatherings of people on the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Is it improper for me to ask? I mean, how big is that clan up there? How big is that community? How many are there?
Well, I'm going to not answer that question because that's actually a really important thing, and the answer to that question is in the finale tomorrow night.
Really? Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah.
That's better than the spoiler. because I've been wondering all along, because we see central cast members, but it's obvious that they can pull together group meetings and they have group dynamics let me ask you, where did the I hesitate to say use the word political, Peter, but the leadership structure, where does that come from, or does it come from anywhere but your imagination?
It's pretty much mine and the imagination of the other producers and writers. I will say that we're just pulling stuff from everything, and when we talk about the leadership and the family and everything, it's like people will reference everything from Shakespeare to Star Wars to Lord of the Rings to anything. So we kind of wanted there to be a sense of this being like a little bit of a classical drama, in a very different location. So yeah, I mean, the funny thing about the utopia dystopia thing is, I love the Ferrells and I love how they live, and I wish I could, live like them in this kind of peer community and everything else. It would be so wonderful. On the other hand, they are a big family, and they spend a lot of time together because that's really the only place that they have to live. And so, like any big extended family, they've got their problems. And the problems are more fun and dramatic than the easygoing fun times up there. So it might be that we're getting a sense that it would be very, very hard to be a feral. But I think on the other hand, there's like lots of great things about their lifestyle too.
Well, indeed. And I don't know how much you pay attention to the publicity or the social media of it or anything, Peter, but do you see, are you seeing little factions out there in support of various and sundry characters?
Well, I don't pay that much attention to it, to be honest, because I just don't really want all that stuff to influence me too much, but one way or the other, I don't even read reviews. Like, I used to read reviews when I did theater, and they would either make me, throw me into some kind of, crazy ego trip or make me really depressed, and so I realized I just should ignore them. But I will say this, that there's a lot on the internet about Hassel and Sally Ann, who they're calling Sassel, and there's been a lot of videos created about them and just a whole lot of fan stuff going on, and not just about them, but all the other characters too. There's all sorts of fan memes that have been going around that I've seen on Facebook and stuff. So I love that. I mean, it was one of the things that when I was creating the show was like, I want to create something that gets out into the culture and that people talk about and that people really care about,
Well, and in Hassel and Sally Ann, you talked about classical themes. You've definitely got a couple of star-crossed lovers there.
No question about that.
My wife, I will tell you, looked at me after last week's episode and said, "Craik had better be okay. I like Craik." So you've got people investing, making emotional investments in the program. Let me ask you. No content or anything. But what's the plan now that you're green-lighted? What's the plan for season two?
Well, let's see. What can I say without giving anything away? Lots of big surprises. I'll say that season one we really establish who the characters are and what the situation is, and then I think in season two we're putting everybody to the test and we're giving all of the characters their own really specific journeys that's going to really test them and change them in a big way. And I think that viewers will be really happily surprised by where we're going to go.
Now, everything that you have shown us so far is green, is in a setting that has green leaves on trees. Is that the plan going forward? I mean, you're going to start shooting soon?
Yeah, we start shooting around mid-May. And it's a good question. We can't really, it would be very, very, very hard to shoot outdoors in the winter, just from a production point of view. And then in a story point of view, season one takes place over about 6 weeks of real time. So we're picking up, and we started, the first night celebration would have been the summer solstice, which is like June 21st. So 6 weeks after that puts us into early mid-August.
Well, I heard I heard a reference to the coming harvest.
Yeah, but that's going to be a month or more away.
Okay.
So we're picking up. We'll pick up season two where season one left off, which you'll see tomorrow.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Peter Matei, thank you very, very, very much for taking time for this conversation. I'm even more intrigued than I already was, and I know I have a feeling that many more people are as well. One last question before you go: in terms of viewing, and this is not a critique or anything, but there are cable systems out there that don't have WGN on them.
I know that.
What are the alternatives?
I'm going to buy a van and I'm going to drive around and give anyone WGN that I can. No, I wish I could. I don't know how that stuff all works. I do know that I wish I had like a number to call or something that I could give people that they could call in and complain, but I don't. I know that they're expanding their viewership. I also know that the show will be available to stream on something like a Netflix or a Hulu or something like that. I don't know. We don't know what it is yet, and I don't know when that will be, but it will be out there for binge streaming at some point.
Well, I was just looking at the IMDb page, and there's a link there that says watch now on Amazon Video. I haven't seen it on Amazon Prime. But it is available on iTunes, is it not?
I believe so, yeah, if you want to pay for it individually. And Amazon, too, I guess.
And I've paid for a few episodes, so it's not a debilitating cost. And you can get early on in the season, I found out, you can subscribe for the whole season at a lower rate than if you just go along buying episode by episode by episode. So people may find that valuable. Well, again, I know one says break a leg to actors. I don't know if one says that to the creator of a program, but
sure.
But certainly break a leg in the upcoming season, and I'm gonna be excited to see what happens tomorrow night. Is tomorrow night just is it the regular 1 hour program or is it extended?
It's a regular 1 hour program.
Okay, very good. Well, Peter Matei, creator of Outsiders on WGN America, thank you very, very kindly. And
no, thank you.
Maybe in another year's time we'll be having the "Oh, that's what happened" conversation and what's coming up in season three. I sure hope we do.
I look forward to it.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Peter Matei, creator of Outsiders, Tuesday nights on WGN America, also available for viewing online at episodes for purchase at iTunes, and as well, apparently, if what I'm seeing at IMDb is correct, on Amazon Video. So, if you haven't watched it, you've got, I guess, until next winter, or you've got this interim while they're shooting season two to binge watch what has gone thus far. I love this program, and I think you know if you're a regular listener to the program that I don't invest a lot of time in TV viewing. But this one grabbed me. Obviously, the Appalachian angle spoke to me. And I just I wanted to see what someone looking with fresh eyes at the region and at the region's storytelling potential would have to say about it. And this says a lot. It is a fantasy of sorts, but it's not. Peter made reference to Game of Thrones there at one point. It's not just, you know, its own separate world. It's not, you know, it's not Middle Earth with hillbillies. It's its own very, very real thing. And there, I was surprised by the frankness of it. And by that I don't mean, you know, they use some of them words. I mean the sort of unblinking, unflinching way that they deal with a well, a region that has its own hard realities, I guess, is the best way to put it. So tomorrow night, 9 p.m., WGN America. Tune in. If you haven't started watching it, I had an email from Mike saying, I heard you talking about Outsiders, so just last night the wife and I sat down to watch, but the DirecTV just has episodes 9 through 13 on demand, and it's not on Netflix yet. So if you want to go back and find it at iTunes or maybe look at Amazon, I'm not sure. It's all right. I'm looking in the chat room here. Lottie says we expect the death of the coal company lady to be brutal and bloody. Well, if there's any justice in the universe, it will be. That is one nasty woman. Of course, you know, coal company executive. What do you want? She's Don Blankenship in Pumps. I mean, I don't know. No spoilers for those who haven't watched. She's just nasty. So, if you haven't seen it yet, catch up with it. The first three episodes, I believe, are still viewable for free at WGNAmerica.com. So you can get those three. And then, like Mike, you've got to fill in that gap from, what, episode 4 to episode 9? Yeah. No, Lottie, she is not Don Blankenship in drag. I gotta give Hollywood that much credit. I don't think you could find a woman ugly enough to be an actual representation of Don Blankenship. yeah. So, check it out tomorrow evening. I will close the program here and then run into the bedroom where Agnes and I will get all set up, all Mike and Carol Brady and watch Outsiders and because I'm kind of stoked for this, as if you couldn't tell. Quit it, Lottie. Lottie says, "Oh, a little lipstick, some eyeshadow, you never know." And I thought I was bad just saying Don Blankenship in Pumps. And for our friends, members of the Horn Family Community Congregation listening up over, Oz is in the house and representing, and they are both some fine actors. And from my perspective, one of them's real pretty. We'll leave it at that before I get all Brent Musburger. So it is, the transition is always a little bit difficult. From something cool like that to, oh, Jesus, dealing with morons. Because it is, you know, Moran Monday. And there's not much way to get around that. For, like it says in the Bible, the morons ye have always with ye. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we got, as usual, I wish it was different. But we got a bumper crop. No, really. And where to start? Well, I think I'll forego the carnival barker this evening. This is going to be, and you know, I'm not pleased at this. I wish this hadn't happened. But it did. And no, it's not earth-shattering. No, it's not... it's not going to impact anyone's lives. But it is, well, you know, I've been at this for a number of years now, and there are things that get under my skin. And I've run this particular clip in the past. And I'm going to say past because, well, this is a clip that goes back to 2010 from something called David Mitchell's Soapbox. Don't know much about David Mitchell, but apparently he is a longtime practitioner of the art of word knowing. And this goes way, way back to, I think, the days of the horn section, when John Fox and Peter Godbold and I used to spend an hour a night between the between like 10 and 11 and midnight. That's what it was, 11 and midnight. Just sort of kicking around the stories of the day and having some fun. And I'm pretty sure it was John who put me onto this clip. So we're going to go with this just as the sort of setup to our first Moran nomination of the evening.
Dear Americans, as you know, everyone in Britain knows the Queen, and she's asked me to have a quick word with you on her behalf about her English. Don't worry, this isn't the standard tedious British sneering about lieutenants and aluminum. Essentially, her message is, use it how you like. She doesn't mind. She doesn't mind about the sensible ones, like spelling plough the way it quite obviously should be spelt, but nor does she mind about the silly ones, like saying tidbit, because you think the syllable tit is intrinsically rude. By all means, leave the U out of colour if it bothers you. I can quite see that the bit of a car you put stuff in looks more like a trunk than a boot, and that sidewalks are the bit at the side that you walk on. Fine, says the Queen. Help yourself. She couldn't care less.
Time out real quick. If it's, I didn't know. What is a sidewalk in the UK? Never mind. It's what's coming that matters.
Fine, says the Queen. Help yourself. She couldn't care less. She couldn't care less, though. Not she could care less. That's the one thing she'd really like you to stop saying. Because that, as an expression for not or hardly caring, just makes no sense. If you could care less about something, then all you're telling us is that you do care at least a little bit. Because you could care less. But if you couldn't care less... Look, observe this graph. Here's me on the scale of caring. I'm at zero. Therefore, since negative caring is impossible, or rather is simply caring of another sort, love and hate being different sides of the same coin, etc., etc., I couldn't care less. I could care more, but I couldn't care less. If I could care less, I would have to care at least the smallest possible unit of caring in order to give myself room to care less. I can't care nothing if I could care less. But I might care much more than nothing. I could care anything from here to here. And I could still truthfully claim to be able to care less. I could care less is absolutely useless as an indicator of how much you care, because the only thing it rules out is that you don't care at all, which is exactly what you're trying to convey. So that's the one thing I really want... The Queen really wants you to stop saying. Although, while I've got you, the expression is, can you hold the fort?
Never mind that part. It's the couldn't care less part. And the fact of the matter is, in this family, this little family of mine, and at this point you're probably thinking, oh, his poor children. It is not easy to convey. Okay. Thank you. Robert in Australia has answered the question. In the UK and Australia, A sidewalk is a footpath. And see, it, okay, I understand. Yep. I can see where, but I can see where David Mitchell thinks that, yeah, that's good, sidewalk. It's a part of the side that you walk on. And you, I mean, we've done some good things with the language here. But could care less. For a very long time, and long before 2010, that, and I, maybe there's a pill. I haven't seen the ad yet on TV telling me to ask my doctor about Knock It Off, the miracle prescription drug for people who can't help but want to hear English spoken something approaching reasonably well, or grammatically or syntactically close to correct. Because I'm, well, I mean, I don't try real hard on this program. I mean, if you hand me a Shakespeare script and say, get up there on those boards and now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this sun of York and all the clouds that louder over our housetops in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. I can try. And if I worked really hard at it, I would probably get rid of the southernness of my, because I used to do that for a living. But as we raise our kids, we tried to teach them to speak decently before they entered the school system. Going back to my own father, yes and no and not yeah and nah. We worked really hard on that. We weren't all obsessive about yes sir and no sir and yes sir and no yes ma'am and no ma'am and I don't know ma'am and but yes and no, and actually finishing words and letting them have distinct endings. We're big, and it's been big in my family. At least part of it, well, lots of parts, several parts of it, for generations. Because one of the things that attaches to Southerners in the United States, and I'll play on it myself, is the assumption that if one speaks with a Southern accent, one is, by definition, stupid. And so we decided to teach our children early on enough that when they got into socialization situations, that they wouldn't that they would at least have a fighting chance. And I don't know where or when could care less entered our vocabulary. But it damned sure did. And it's a sign of intellectual laziness. I couldn't care less. It was probably started out by somebody who said, I couldn't care less. And tree beard and celery somewhere along the way morphed it into, oh, I could care less. Until that is what the phrase now is, and I'm kind of an asshole about it. When people say, well, I could care less, I look at them and say, ah, so you care. How much do you care? No, I didn't say that. Yes, you did. Of course, now with our concealed carry bill coming into effect in May, that's probably on the list of things I should stop doing. Yeah, and it has its regional and scatological variances. I could get, like, I could give a shit. which gets even more complicated. But it's there. It's really there. And it's really annoying to people who practice the art of knowing words. And so it was that I, last night, sort of said, no, and if it had come from any of the mouth breathing, knuckle walking turds on two legs of the right wing, I wouldn't have bothered with this. But over on this week with George Snuffleupagus, somebody over there asked Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton about the latest stream of invective emanating from that biological sewer known as the mouth of T-Rump. And yuckity. I mean, he's disgusting. Okay, it just is. He's vulgar. He is without anything resembling manners. But this is ground over which we have been. And the cause for the latest kerfuffle is a tweet by T. Rump referring to Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton as Crooked Hillary. Now, once you've seen all the various photographs that are out there, and there are a bunch, it's kind of reminiscent of the picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein back in the 80s and grinning like a fox eating shit out of a wire brush. There's lots of photos out there of Bill and Hillary with Donald Trump and whichever person, woman he was married to at the time, or with his kids, or with his kids and his wife. And so that aspect of it, knowing that they, you know, and they're all inscribed, you know, to Hillary, to Donald, oh my God. Warmest regards. Oh, you're wonderful. Oh, she's lovely. What a brain. Blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, now you see the tweet that comes out calling her Crooked Hillary, and you kind of go, oh, wrestling, is it? Down to the Armory? Saturday night at the Barton Civic Center? Is that where we're going? So there's that aspect to it. But on this week, they asked Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton to offer some sort of a response to the Crooked Hillary comment from T. Rump. To which she said here's what she said. No funny voices here. What I'm concerned about is how he goes after everybody else. He goes after women. He goes after Muslims. He goes after immigrants. He goes after people with disabilities. He is hurting our unity at home. Whatever that means. He is undermining the values that we stand for in New York and across America, and he's hurting us around the world. He can say whatever he wants to say about me. I really could care less. No, really, there's got to be some kind of medication that can help me. Because I was okay with everything right down to that sentence right there at the end. We have been told time after time after time after time, ad infinitum, ad nauseam, that this is the most educated, most capable, most prepared, most intelligent, most ready on day one, most ready for the 3 a.m. phone call, most well-versed in foreign policy, most thoroughly briefed in domestic policy, most steel-trap legal-minded woman who has ever walked the planet. And that is why she is inevitably going to be president. It's her turn. We have to. Tina, there is no alternative. The earth will cease to turn upon its axis. The universe itself might just give up the ghost and die. If the most intelligent, most educated woman on the face of the planet is not made president, then we get that. I really could care less. And if that doesn't qualify for a Moran Monday nomination, I don't know what does. And it's in a way, it's not even so. It's an indication, you know. And I don't want to go out and set up l'Académie Anglaise. We don't need some building somewhere, probably in D.C., dedicated to the preservation of the English language. The reason English is English is because it is in many ways a lingua franca to the world. We've never been particularly snooty about keeping it pure. If that was the case, we'd never have gotten even as far as Juanata Prula with the Shurzuta. That's Middle English, not the old stuff. Neither you nor I could probably understand a word of Old English. Because that was the Neo-Germanic language spoken by the Angles when they decided to take that boat trip from Frisia, was it? And cross the channel, and hey, look, an island. A three-hour tour. No more singing! English is constantly changing, and it's, you know, 70% of the words in the English language are derived from Latin. There's another chunk of it that's Germanic. We've sucked up words from everything from Farsi to Arabic to Haudenosaunee. To Japanese. God knows, to Spanish. Oodles of French. In English. You know the problem with the French? They don't have a word for entrepreneur. And you know what? I'm sure at some point in time, probably several points in time, during the 8 years of the Reign of Error, dim leader George W. Bush said, I could care less. Fuck Saddam. We're taking him out. He tried to kill my daddy. And I and we expected it of him. But this is the most intelligent, most educated woman who has ever walked on the face of the planet. Just ask her surrogates. Ask her partisans. They will tell you. And we get I could care less. And that's the thing. I really could care less about this. I probably should care less about this. Even as we speak, Agnes is probably preparing the Thorazine dart. Oh, Bob, look over here. Ah. Ron, you may be right. Ron and Raleigh with a note says, I believe that the expression, I could care less, has become common usage in much the same way that where are you at has. I hear it everywhere. You hear it everywhere. On the street and on broadcast media, it gets on my last nerve. How did it become common usage? I guess it's because it's heard so often. And that's probably the case. And it probably starts, and this is what happens when you don't it's an education thing. You know, I'm really not right there with the French on changing a quarter pounder to a Royal avec fromage. But I guess ignorance will out. Unless she meant to say what she said. And that she really does care what Donald Trump says about her. And I suspect she does. Indeed. James writing in, she could care less. Give her time. Yeah, so enough of that, but it was a starting place, right? Right. What else? Well, let's see. Funniest thing I saw today, in opposition to North Carolina's anti-LGBT law, HB2, Nickelback have threatened that if the law is not repealed, they will go to North Carolina and give a concert. All right, let's, among other things, having filibobstered, well, not really filibobstered that long, but after our conversation with Peter and Peter Mattei and that little linguistic digression, let's open the phones. Maybe you've got some more ends you want to talk about. I've got some more ends I want to talk about. And odds are, we can talk about all of them. Oh, look. It's the Bundy brothers. They're on the list. Yeah. And there's our partners in peace. The Saudis. Yeah. Oh, lots and lots. Lots of more ends. Definitely lots of more ends. Lots and lots of more ends. Oh, and hey, look, we've got an airline to nominate for more in Monday. And in advance of the New York primary tomorrow, I thought we might take a look toward clearing up some questions about the process there. I saw those erupting online over the weekend. Because New York has a rather, well, there are some unique elements to voting in New York. And in point of fact, I was told just before airtime that our buddy Steve in New York is out there knocking on doors for Bernie, even as we speak. Steve's over in the Bronx. Good on you, Steve. Good on you. So, yeah, there's a lot of potential here. And some, you know, some personal nominations. Once again, relating to the attempt to vote in the United States. People listening from around the world. Every time we do one of these stories, every time we have one of these stories, and I don't mean we, as in me and that mouse in my pocket, or that I'm the queen of freaking England. I mean we collectively as a nation who can't seem to quite get it right in this whole idea of the franchise and being able to express one's personal will as to who will represent one in various offices at a county, city, state, national level. And we're just kind of hamstrung by it. And sadly, it makes things a bit of a mess. So, all kinds of stuff out there. And again, we are trying to raise $400 this evening and every evening this week because of my absence next week. So that we won't get in some kind of god-awful hole and crap get turned off or whatnot. And there is a $100 challenge on the table, courtesy of Chris in Germany. Chris will match the first $100 that come in. And, of course, I would be remiss if I did not note that political seasons, political years, presidential political years in particular, make it hard for independent broadcasting. Because the urgency with which we, and I'm not challenging it, I'm not criticizing it, but the urgency that attends our political process takes a big bite out of our ability to self-fund. So with that having been said, we've been having a hard time of it. We've been having a hard time reaching the monthly goals. We've just squeaked in under the wire the last couple of months. And remember, the Beat the Sweet All Year Long challenge is also on the table. We are now past the halfway mark of April. And remember, this month's Beat the Swede extra is $80. And that's a big deal around these parts. So, we'll take a little break and see if you want to engage in any conversation. All the lines are open. Area code 304-574-8178 is one of the lines. The other line, we call the stress line, is area code 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676. And, of course, from anywhere on the planet, you can always reach me on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B. KINCAIDHORN is the account to reach out to. If you've never done that before, include some little message like Horn family or, you know, hey Bob, let's talk or whatever. I will not clear your request if you turn out if you tell me that you're a Nigerian widow who has $10 million that you need me to help you claim. Just so we're clear on that. All right, then. Break time. And light up the phones if you wish, or God knows. There's plenty for me to fill a Bobster on about. Your choice entirely. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Can you tell me? just exactly where I've been. Is that so much to ask? I'll pay you back no matter what the test. You seem really sure about something I don't know. Take that load off, looks like your chest's about to go. Your wasted words already been heard. All you really got, yes or no? Are you really Satan? Yes or no? Tell me now, please. Watch it on TV.
Seemed appropriate. Wasted Words from the Allman Brothers Band. Long distance dedication going out to Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Let's jump over to the phones and get right to it. Somewhere down in the big peninsula of Florida, Stan. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm well.
This is, yeah, Marshall Payne. I go by Doug, but I'm sure you recognize me from our mutual little community here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And from our mutual benefactress, the Queen of the Minions, Carol Baker.
Yes, sir. That's right.
So do you prefer Doug or Marshall?
I do, Doug. I mean, you can call me whatever you like, but I mean, everybody in my circle, I guess, calls me Doug, so... you go ahead and use it.
Then Doug, it shall be. Good to hear from you for the first time.
Absolutely. I've been meaning to call in for quite some time, but, you know, if anybody's going to get me to do it, it's Carol Baker.
you refuse Carol Baker at your peril.
That's right.
So anything particular, bees under bonnets, burrs under saddles, or?
You know, there's several things, really. I mean, you know, one could talk about the faux pas, you know, a la myriad of Hillary Clinton, but I guess, you know, what is it? I would say, really, just all these so-called religious freedom bills that are popping up en masse, you know, everywhere. And I guess at the head of that, what's his name, the Family Research Council, Tony Perkins, I believe.
Yes, Tony, Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins, yes.
That's right. Yeah, I was watching, you know, I like to go to Raw Story, the website. I'm sure you might be familiar with it, but they get some pretty good headlines sometimes with some of the various nonsensical things going on. And I just sort of saw something here recently with Tony Perkins trying to justify to a news reporter that essentially wasn't going to have any of it, trying to, you know, put his angle across. And the only angle that any supporter of the religious freedom bill will proffer to you is that it defends the freedom of religion, which really is just a code for Christianity. But yeah, you know, it's interesting for me, I guess, earlier saying a reporter basically took them apart limb by limb, and the only thing you can say is, duck, dive. No, it's defending liberty. You know, because no one wants to talk about what the actual effects of any of these bills are. You know, I think the favorite defense, and you'll get this from the state governors as well, just like the North Carolina state governor, is that they'll if you try to point out what, are you still there, Bob? I apologize.
Oh, I am.
Okay. I don't think I'm making sure I'm going to just talking, you know, myself silly, but no, but what they'll end up saying is if you point at any of the direct results, you know, of these bills, they'll try to tell you that you're just drumming up a hysteria. You know, it's all the left, it's the LGBT, you know, lobby. It's more powerful than the NRA.
Brian Fisher over at American Family Association Radio in the Name of Jesus refers to it as big gay. You know, just like big tobacco, big guns, big oil, big coal, big gas. Big gay.
Yeah, you know, but here's the deal. You know, it's like, let's break it down. You know, it's a special interest group, okay? All groups and whatever their demand, right, for bartering, lobbying for a certain outcome is a special interest group.
Madison in the first days of the Constitutional Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Madison referred to it and the term for it back in the Enlightenment period of the late 18th century was faction. And they railed against faction and they inveighed against faction. And then they realized they were going to have faction whether they liked it or not.
And who was this? Which individual did you say?
That's James Madison.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. And I guess, you know, whatever monarchy.
But I mean, Washington. I mean, they were all just wrought by the idea of it. Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton. Of course, Madison and Hamilton were the two principal authors of the Federalist Papers. And it's in Federalist 10 where you get the broadest description of faction. And I guess we could say, Doug, that they are you're ever going to be with us because people have different interests and the interests get more broadly different the bigger the country gets.
Exactly. And really the problem is, you know, right, there's an endemic, right, demand for any group to promote itself. So that's just a characteristic of humanity, right? So really the problem comes in, how do they, seek to further their agendas, right? What the manner of which, and to whom, who gets listened to, right? So when we say, oh, big this corporation, that corporation, right? We're not saying necessarily that, you know, or not big corporation, but big group, you know, whether it be big LGBT or big coal.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, where... There's, to me, Doug, there's a difference between, say, advocating for human rights, which is advocating for an expansion of rights that already belong to people, and advocating for things that are financially related. Nobody is going to get directly wealthy just because they can get married. On the other hand, the religion industry, especially theocrats like Tony Perkins, these guys are getting richer than God Almighty Himself off of the hatred that appears to lie inherent in the fundamentalist, mostly Protestant, but to some extent Roman Catholic, etc., areas of our spiritual life. So, consequently, I do see a distinction there. Now it's my turn to ask if I still have you. Doug? Huh. Well, that's, I don't know where.
Yeah.
There you are.
No, I think I'm not used to using my wife's phone. My cheek touched the mute sensor. You know, sorry, yeah. But yes, I'm calling you. But right, so exactly, that is the pertinent, you know, I guess, aspect of it that I was getting to, is that, you know, when he says, oh, you know, big gay, ooh, you know, it's so scary. You know, these are people who are simply fighting for a very specific set of things. But no, right. And right. What I'm saying is they're saying it out of both sides of his mouth. You know, he's supporting his agenda. But anyway,
And interestingly, you brought up Tony Perkins. But based on some reading I've done recently, guess who is driving most of these, I refer to them as potty bills. It's not Tony Perkins. It's a different theocrat. It's the weird pettifogging lawyer who represented sister clerk Kim Davis. Liberty Council, which I think is actually headquartered right there in your very own little old state.
Yeah, you know, there's a really interesting number of groups here out of Florida. Good old Debbie Wasserman Schultz is from here. Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She's a delight.
Just ask her, she'll tell you.
I know, absolutely. In between all of her high business meetings and her
friends in the payday loan industry.
Actually, you gotta get those payday loans, Bob. You've gotta get some.
I mean, there's one on every other corner in Florida, isn't there? You know, the corner that doesn't have a church already on it.
I mean, absolutely. But you know, and it really does hurt our service members too. You know, you wouldn't believe, I was in the Marine Corps, but you wouldn't believe how often a command, after the fact, after a service member is thrown through the loop, because these are the exact kind of people, you know, loan to loan, they leave back their spouses with a power of attorney who are trying to take care of families, who get caught up in these things right off base. And if the commander, generally you have to come back off and, you know, create a ban list of businesses. Every command has a ban list of businesses. Anyway, so what I'm trying to say is...
Yeah, wait, I didn't know that. So, it goes beyond saying... Marine, we highly recommend that you not frequent this business, to thou shalt not.
Oh, absolutely. I remember there was a series, you know, I went to a training command in near Baltimore, so Anne Arundel, right off the Anne Arundel, Fort Meade. Anyways, I was at the Defense Information School there, and the commander there, there's a long list of hotels, for instance, that you cannot patronize, because if you're...
Oh, I think we muted again.
Sure.
I think we muted. Yeah, there we go. A long list of hotels you can't patronize because...
Right, because they're on the ban list. Because I guess what would happen is, right, drug deals or some kind of criminality or, you know, just getting, you know, Marines going there or whomever. You know, there's different sort of, it was a joint service command. There's sailors and Navy, anyways. But, right, is there some kind of nonsense would come back that would give the command too much of a headache? And at a threshold, the commander has every discretion to say, that business will not be patronized any longer. But right, so what I'm trying to say is specifically, payday loans is absolutely terrible, and it's an endemic problem for people at a certain income level, specifically enlisted military members. That is a huge problem.
Well, and of course, let's understand that in capitalist America, people like military service members exist to provide a means of making money for the finance industry, right? I mean, isn't that how it works?
Well, right on their backs, you know it. Right off their backs, rather. But
So let me digress for a minute, Doug, because you have shared this aspect of your. Of your personal history with us.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that we are taught or encouraged to understand out here in the civilian world is that the military is one great big monolithic right-wing fighting machine.
You know,
you don't sound all right-wingy. I don't think you got up this morning listening to Lee Greenwood.
No. But I really, you know, hesitate to tell you I'm not that typical of a service member. And, you know, of course they're not all right-wing. You know, I've met and spoken to plenty of people. It really depends on the service. So, you know, I can only speak to my service and my experience in the Marine Corps. But I would tell you that since, you know, probably World War II and on, it's probably progressively moved. The scale has been hit in the favor, probably, of right-wing recruiting. It's just, especially because it's volunteer-based, I'd say. Much more, you know, as a volunteer recruiting cycle now instead of it being...
So that changes the population dynamic of people who would get involved. Is that part of it?
I think it's tipped the scale, and honestly... You know, I hate to be one of those people, but maybe it might be a good idea. You have to look at if it's a good idea. But having, you know, part of the free college and all this kind of stuff, I think there should be some kind of volunteer service. And I don't mean to jump on that bandwagon or push that rhetoric right off the bat. But in some way, but it might, I guess, maybe better encourage people's public service in one organization or another. Just because, you know, I think. Too many young people, probably, and too many left-leaning young people are disengaged from service in the public realm. Anyway, that's the...
Well, I think you're right. And originally, the Peace Corps was sort of designed to fill some of that need.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, the Peace Corps got... its trust was damaged, Doug, because countries where Peace Corps workers went... often came to wonder if not necessarily because anything some Peace Corps kid did, but because of the way the federal government operated, governments began to wonder, hey, I wonder if these people are actually CIA.
Hmm.
And that, you know, that didn't help things.
No, and a lot of it is climate, and a lot of it is oversight, you know. An organization start out, you know, as part of the planning fallacy, I think they don't understand the dynamics that they're going to be mired in whenever they go, you know, try to be involved. But no, I agree. I think we've been dealt a setback in that way, to some degree. I mean, you know, you really have to get in and look at it, but largely, I would say many, especially with the military, maybe not all government organizations, but as far as the military is concerned, it's pretty left-leaning. I wouldn't say like 80 or 90%, but I'd say probably 60%, 65%.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So I was looking at Facebook a little bit ago, and I noticed that you have come up with your own list of Moran Monday folks, ignoramuses, dullards. I've got it here. Yeah, imbeciles, chumps, weasels, ignoramuses. Step right up, drop in your quarter, and have a listen at what the damn dullards have gone and done now.
That's right. You know, that doesn't seem to be any end to the stream of it, you know.
Well, so you're, without asking you to give away too much, are you in, like, deep southern Florida, or are you up in redneck Florida?
Well, I'm up in redneck Florida right now. I'm in the panhandle.
Oh, you're in lower Alabama.
I mean, the topography over here, it might as well be, you know, Louisiana fan or Georgia fan or something like that, to be honest with you. You know, the white folk over here ain't all that great, I'll tell you that much.
Well, and you, I'm sure there is no dearth of Confederate battle flags most anywhere you look.
No. There's definitely no shortage of that. But, you know, to some extent, I'm in more of the city. I'm next to Tallahassee. I've been going to FSU for some time, but no, I would say, as per usual, our living arrangement, you know, in my life experience, has always been very conservative, very right wing leaning. And I wouldn't, not where we live predominantly, because we have, you know, the diversity of this city is quite diverse, but with respect to white voters where we live, they are very right-wing. They're very Republican-leaning. You follow what I'm saying?
Oh, I do. And in point of fact, there's a kind of a convergence here. I happen to spend a couple of hours both Saturday and Sunday, Doug, watching a live stream of drag racing from South Alabama. And it was fun, and it was cool, and it's always a joy to hear the accent. And you know, there was nothing overtly political about it, and so I'm not trying to directly politicize it, but because of who I am, I couldn't help but just watch people pulling up to the starting line and blah, 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 those big engines. I mean, it's exciting. It's fun as hell. But just knowing that probably I don't know, because you really couldn't see into the cars. But first of all, I'm just assuming that probably north of 90% of the people that I was looking at would run, not walk, not crawl, but run to the polls to vote for Family Values Republicans. And I mention this because Alabama is presently embroiled in scandal because of their family values. One man, one woman, sacred biblical marriage governor having been caught a-romping with one of his aides. And you probably recognize the accent. You know what a-romping means.
I do.
Yeah, that's hillbilly for in flagrante delicto.
That's right.
Which is Latin for in bed.
Been buying up all those, you know, buy your pay your phones, just, you know, toss that one out the window, delete those text messages. But someone finally got, you know, got wind of it.
But the question, you know, and it continues to dog the nation. What do we got to do to drag the South kicking and screaming back into the Union? Because the South is a member of the United States, only nominally at best. I was reading another article over by who wrote it? one of the, James Zogby, I think. And it was published at the American Arab Institute website. He was just writing for himself, not for the Institute. But he was talking about his support for Bernie Sanders. And he said, and his jumping off place was back when a news report, a recent news report, that Utica Industries, or Utica Textiles, now of North Carolina, was packing up the mill, bag and baggage, part and parcel, and heading off to China. And that it was going to devastate that area of North Carolina where it existed. And what he said is, I remember when Utica mills were in Utica, New York. And they left Utica, New York because the South promised non-union labor at cheap rates. And so they left Utica and left Utica to die. And now what they did to Utica is being done to them. And I sort of reflected, Doug, on the fact that this has been going on for a while. I mean, the textile industry in the South became the textile industry in the South because they raided and waged economic warfare by virtue of low wages and right to work and anti-union policies and so forth. They waged that economic war on the North long after the Civil War was supposedly over. And now they find it being waged on them in the form of a so-called free trade agreement. And yet, well, they can't quite learn, can they?
No, they can't because they aren't looking at what they're doing. They're walking around with ideology in their head, right? And it's funny because the conservative base, you know, the more you impoverish the conservative base, the more loyal they're going to be, really. It seems like there's some kind of inverse relation between that. You know, the harder life is and the more they got to fill it with disgust and anger and hatred at somebody, the more, you know, the elites that within their own party, with, you know, maybe not historically, but it is certainly the case now. And, you know, I had an economics professor that I was in his class a year or so ago. And really, I took interest in it because the Koch brothers, I don't know if you know this, but they were going around for a while, you know, a year or two ago, maybe even 3 years now when they were first doing this, but they were buying up all the economic departments. And not buying them up literally, but they were buying off professors by basically saying, we'll give y'all such and such amount of money if you give us, right, control, basically, over, you know, the graduate students coming in and the departments. Anyways, long story short, I was in a class with one of these guys who was in deep with him, and he's one of these who's written all these texts and everything else, and I remember one of the first things I did was I was asking about all these tax conversions or, you know, you're familiar with the term tax conversion, correct?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Right, well, they're doing much of what you're saying. They're moving their headquarters, they're moving their, either their supply chain or their taxes and, you know, so certainly things out there. And, I was basically trying to give them heck over it. And I can't remember what he tried, instead of facing it, the problem, that's what the thing is. They don't want to talk about the brass tacks. They don't care if you're talking about the religious freedom bill and their proponents, or the people who are proponents of tax inversion, you know, which is, you know, I don't understand, like you're saying, I don't know how they're for something that's hurting their own base at the same time. Anyways, all I'm trying to say is, of course, it's madness, you know, because the truth is the base and even the people running the tax inversion, they've gotten such a cognitive dissonance between their motivation and their ends that they don't even know why it's happening. You know what I mean? They've divorced the actors from their concerns. Does that make any sense? Are you following what I'm saying?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You're saying it. I struggle with it, and you're saying it better than I do.
Oh, if I'm saying it better than you, I can barely follow myself right now. Because you know, right. Because these are very deep and broad issues. And they're all kind of related to one another. But the biggest thing is that, you know, these aren't problem solvers. None of these people are problem solvers, right? These are people who are parochial, right, in their interests and their goals. These are people who are nativists, right? They love their state or their jingoist. They love their country or their business, right? And these are people who value the bravado of taking some kind of action ideologically, right? So inherently, from the bottom to the ceiling, their actions are just divorced from the real world problems that they're facing. So, I mean, that's just broad strokes what happens. But, you know, if their left hand could talk to their right hand, for goodness sakes, I think that they would stop doing something. But really, you know, if I could bounce that idea off of another one, I'm sure you follow Fox News very closely, they're on MSNBC now. Nita, you know, Buflapuflapla.
Scar, yeah. And the meat puppet, as yep. Charlie Pierce calls him.
Oh, you know very clearly who I'm talking about. But very recently, I've seen he started to go on this populist, this focused rant against the elite. And now I've realized that the elites—they're so terrible. And what's so funny to me is that all of a sudden you start seeing within the right wing, right, as it's crumbling for goodness knows how many reasons, a smattering now is starting to realize, you know, in a very light way, that we need to stop doing these kinds of things. You know what I mean? And not, like I said, I don't think for a moment they're going to follow through, but they're, you know, I think even within their own party now, to some very light extent, they're starting to realize, you know, folks creating tax havens and doing all kinds of, you know, gobbledygook rigmarole with relocating. You know, like look at Trump's biggest thing. You've got a significant number, a majority of Republican voters jumping up and down, clapping their hands, you know, mouth agape, you know, cackling every time Trump says, that if someone, takes business away from a state and puts it in Mexico or tries to take business out of our country, that he's going to punish them. He's going to find a way to punish them. I'm just trying to say that related to your idea and what you're saying is hard to understand within a party or a group of people that take the economic interests away from themselves. You're also having a very small smattering of people. I'm not giving Trump any credit. I'm definitely not giving his base any credit because his base isn't even listening to their narrative ideas. They're laughing and cackling because they just love his persona. But I guess
because these are the same people who love it when they go to wrestling down to the armory.
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter what's coming out of someone's mouth. What matters is the bravado. You see what I'm saying? But all I'm saying is,
the pure entertainment value. You've noted, what you said. I just had a note from the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas, Stan, who says Doug has explained how and why people lick the hands of those who do not feed them.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, if you train a dog to expect to be kicked long enough, the dog likes being kicked, I guess.
That's right, and because believe it or not, they're so divorced. They don't realize that their leader brought them. You know, they got kicked by a different village, right? So the only reason why the other village kicked them is because the leader of the group they belong to created a circumstance in which that wouldn't happen. But yeah.
Well, indeed. I'm looking here at a story, for instance, and. One of the things that has been, and it infects Democrats as well as Republicans, and that is this the great race to the bottom, the big con job, Doug, of come on down and set up your plant here and we'll provide you with cheap labor and no employment rights for the workers. And you know what? We'll pay you out of their money We'll pay you to not pay taxes. So it turns out, over the two terms that Piyush Jindal was governor of Louisianistan, that state is in a horrible budget fix right now. They're in a budget mess just like Kansas is in a budget mess, speaking of the marvelously coherent Diane from Kansas-stan. Well, here's the way those geniuses got to where they are. They have paid out in Louisiana, and pretty soon this turns into real walking around money. They've paid out $210 million more in tax credits and rebates to corporations this year alone than they've collected in corporate income and franchise taxes.
I am
ciphering and Gazinta challenged. But the funny thing is that the corporations are going to demand that they get their credits and rebates, even if Louisiana doesn't have the money to pay them because they haven't been able to bring any revenues in. So who's going to take it on the chin, Doug?
Who else? The American workers, everybody, from everybody below, that's for sure.
And this, this isn't just Louisiana. That's how Alabama and Mississippi get automobile plants. That's how Alabama got Mercedes-Benz, for God's sakes. It's how South Carolina Stan got BMW. You come here and we won't even make you pay nothing to be here. You can be here for free.
It's a very simple reason, right? These things are very simple. How did this happen to any of these situations? Runaway corporate, ideas about, how to create or secure revenue, right? And it's related to this idea of power creep. But what happens is, we've cut payroll, we've cut this, we've cut that, da, 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 da. And you sit there and everybody's now at this stage of the game, almost every business of any worth has these specialist strategic teams, they hire these small teams. But what it always comes down to nowadays, how business is done, is through a slew of loopholes, right? Loopholes, gimmicks, tactics, and everything else. And if they aren't Mitt Romney's of the world, right? Venture capitalists. Hey, let's get this, blast this sucker into bankruptcy, as we evacuate all the wealth and all the capital out of it, right? And I think what it boils down to is everybody has seized upon the one inherent fallacy. Well, there's probably several, but the major inherent fallacy of capitalism, which is, take for instance Appalachia, right, or any of these large environmental habitats that people want to secure, right? So, I don't care if you're talking about the rainforest or what. People look at it and they'll say, you know what? I understand the need to keep all this stuff, but look at all the stuff in there that's right to be used. And so they'll argue about private ownership. Because if it's not, if something's privately owned, I'm going to go on a huge tangent, Bob, and I'm going to beat you over the head as I'm doing it. But okay, I'll run to you. And all I'm trying to say is, when people argue for the power of private ownership or, capitalist business, right, and how they're going, it manages and it keeps everything in alignment, and they believe themselves, they truly do, well, they forgot one damn thing. That one damn thing is that the top most priority is revenue at all costs, and you completely forget the value of a stable labor force, of a stable economic environment, of a stable environment, of the private land. If you forget all that, then you're going to create chaos and you're going to stop your ability to create more revenue. But what happens now is they don't care because they leapfrog, right? If somebody jumps down and destroys Appalachia and then flutters away, well, what's it on their back? You know what I'm saying? Or the same thing in Kentucky, you know, and in any of these states, right, is that what is nailing down that business to stay concerned about its community and how much its community is thriving? And the answer is nothing necessary, right? And so what everybody's leapfrogging for the everybody's believing so clearly in the capitalist promise and the big business beliefs. We've overproduced business beliefs to use loopholes, and we forgot that there are more priorities than the chief priority of capitalism, which is revenue. So right, that's exactly. I don't mean to be so long winded, but that's it. It's nothing more than that, really.
Well, I think you're probably right. And the eternal question is, how do you fix it? I mean, you're studying at the graduate level right now, right?
No, I'm taking a break for right now, really. Soon to be, yeah. But I'm taking a break to work at this time. I got right up to where I was going to graduate with my bachelor's degree in philosophy with a minor in math and economics. But I don't have the button that you've got, Bob, to echo. But what has to change? The public demand has to change, right? And then the public demand has to permeate the business demand. That's all. Right. And where have we done that successfully so far? The LGBTI++, you know, community. Even then, we're getting blowback, but we've permeated business interest with that. Right. So somebody needs to do a meta-analysis of business demand and public opinion permeation, because that has worked wildly successfully with the LGBT community. You know, right, you can say, oh, we've got blowback. Like, look at conservative politicians, look at state governors, and all the new legislation that they've had. But as far as, you see what I'm saying, right?
You have to
sway public opinion, and you have to permeate business behavior. And, I mean, I can't think of a more successful current model other than how much the businesses support today, believe it or not, the LGBT community. You know, just look at North Carolina. Look at the overwhelming response of businesses. Nope, my contract's done. Nope, my concert's done. Hey, I was thinking about buying land here. I was thinking about headquartering here. Nope. So, you know,
yeah, I was just, I've always got to have a bottle of hot sauce around about the house. And over the years, some of it's just gotten too mild for me. I love Frank's hot sauce out of New Jersey, but it just doesn't have enough fire. And my local Wiggling Pig the other day didn't have any Cholula. So I wound up with a bottle of Texas Pete hotter hot sauce. And it is, it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, it comes from, and see, I'm one of these people who believes that consumer choices, I hate the word consumer anyway, but the choices we make in the store are moral choices. They're beyond economics. They are philosophical, moral, ethical choices. So I just happened to be looking. This will be the only bottle of Texas Pete that I will ever buy because it's made by T.W. Garner Food Company of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, 27108, I think, maybe 5, possibly a 6. I don't have my glasses on. And because I'm one of these activist nerds, I'm going to drop them a little line saying, you know, you've got a really good little utility extra hot sauce there. I mean, this stuff could be used for riot control. It's freaking hot. But I'm never going to buy your product anymore because, well, I'm sorry, you're in North Carolina and, you know, your state is apparently overwhelmed with hate.
Right.
I mean, isn't that pretty much, I know this drives the fundies crazy, but isn't that fair? Isn't that what they've done for years? on the right wing? On the right wing? I mean, haven't they reached out and said, we ain't going to buy no Campbell soup because they had a man and a man in one of their commercials?
That's right. I love the guys who, or the folks who would go on there on Facebook and pretend to be customer service. You seen that?
No.
You know, folks, I mean, yeah, you've got, I mean, I've seen them at Target. I've seen, I saw one in response to Campbell soup controversy a while back when it happened. You got folks who, you know, you got mavens of the social media here who hop on there and they create an account that looking at, you know, space one word over or, you know, or did no spaces. And they do like customer service and they would just obliterate these people whining, you know, complaining. And it looks like, because they take them seriously, you know, they're, oh, how dare you speak to me that way? And they're like, you know, we're sorry, ma'am, sir, for your, you know, for your,
I spent 2 days getting called Sir Bob, by a customer service, call center person working for Frontier Communications, who swore that they both did. She and he swore that they were, that they really were in Texas. And when I said, go Cowboys. Not much of an Indians fan, huh?
Maybe production, but, you know, Mr. Tom Bob, you know, Chieftain over there at North Carolina Tourism. But, right. So, I mean, you know, headquarters maybe isn't the same as the production line, or who knows.
Yeah, no, but, they were in Bangalore. It was pretty obvious. Well, Doug, it has been...
over there. I'm gonna send you this letter. No.
Where can I mail this? Yeah, what's the zip code in Mumbai? Yeah.
Somebody went to North Carolina sometime, and I'm pissed off.
Doug, it's been great talking to you. I hope this will not be our last conversation.
No, certainly not.
And our best to our best to the most wonderful 1 year old in the Horn Family Community Congregation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You've got a precious baby there.
Thank you. Well, great talking to you, Bob, and hope to do it again real soon.
Well, let's do. Let's do indeed. Take care, Doug. Be well.
Well, good night.
Bye now.
Bye.
Calling from Florida, our buddy Doug. You can you'll see his comments on my Facebook page. Mighty smart guy. Mighty smart indeed. Let's see. It is about 7 minutes past the hour, and we've got a $100 challenge on the table, courtesy of Chris in Germany, which thus far remains unchallenged. It is a pristine $100 challenge. It is a $100 challenge that has not had any... it has not had any subtractions from it. So hopefully we'll do better as we finish out the third hour of this Morin Monday. Going right back to the phones in a second, but a note coming in from Philip in Maryland. Bob, I agree with you about I could care less, but irregardless... Ow! It seems to be taking over. I have a close friend who routinely uses both, and taking into his account his dyslexia and lack of education, I keep my mouth shut, especially since he routinely uses irregardless. However, as a transplanted Bostonian, we used a response that I never thought about until friends in Dallas were confused by it. We were talking about a documentary, and the speaker said she enjoyed it greatly. I responded, "So didn't I." She then asked, "Well, did you or didn't you?" I called up several friends in Boston who remarked that they didn't use the phrase as they repeated it at times. When I remarked that I apparently use it often to a person, each responded, "I am surprised now that I think of it, don't I?" The other sounds unnatural. I've since adapted to the majority, having lived in exile for 28 years, but when I return to Boston, I fall right into it. What quoth ye, Bob? By the way, I now hear often, he don't agree, she don't agree, or it don't make sense regularly. So if you're asking if others are occasionally irked by such issues, I have to admit, so aren't I. Be well, Philip. Philip, you be well too, didn't I? Dear hey. You know. Right. And let's see, back over to, let's go back out to California. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how the hell are you?
Ah, how the hell are you, Tracy?
Well, you know, it's a gorgeous day in Southern California. I'm walking down the street, the boulevard in Steel Beach, California.
Wait, you're walking? You're walking in California? What? Is the cab, did the cab break down?
No. I'm strolling, actually. No, Will is hanging out with his friends until his hockey game. So I decided just to kind of walk along the boulevard and scare the white people. It's really awesome.
Getting some looks, are we?
Oh, always. Always. But you know me, I don't care. I mean, I just had really good Mexican food and a margarita at a beachside cafe. I can't be real.
Stop it. You just called to taunt me. I knew it.
Yes.
Well, I could care less.
Wouldn't that be... Could you?
Actually, in this case, I really could. I care a lot.
Exactly. Irregardless of the fact.
A note coming from Tim saying, Seal Beach, it's friggin' 20 degrees cooler than where I am. Nice. She's full of it.
It's gorgeous. It is.
We had a beautiful day here in Apalachistan. Not a cloud in the sky. Cerulean blue skies. Got up into mid 70s.
There you go. Using those 50-cent words, Bob. Cerulean.
Well, you buy them. You got to use them or lose them.
So, as a matter of fact, I'm really going to torture you even more, so, because there's this bakery called Sweet Jill's Bakery, where they make everything from scratch.
I need to go ahead and crush up a metformin here?
Yeah, I'm going to go in here in a minute and take pictures and really make you cry. You know, remember back in the day, those sheet cakes that Grandma would make, and a sheet cake is about maybe 2 or 3 inches deep?
Oh, yes, yes. With the homemade frosting?
And the big corner. Yes, and the big corner piece with the frosting,
yeah.
Kind of, that's what they have here.
Oh,
and
no.
So now I've got to decide between just lemon, there's pineapple, let's see. There's, okay, we got, I don't care about German chocolate because I don't like coconut. But we
oh,
have,
no, no, okay, then I'll take all the German chocolate you don't want.
Right. So we've got chocolate cake fudge frosting. I'm talking to a friend of mine on the phone. See, I just told you. And we have, what is this, lemon cake. We have carrot, confetti cake with the little sprinkles on them, with the little confetti. And then they have these big, huge strawberry cupcakes and stuff like that. Did you hang up on me, Bob?
Yum. Damn it, yum.
And then they have cherry cheesecake bars. The whole place is just sinful. But it's a beautiful thing. It is just... Oh, then they have, of course, the chocolate cream cheesecake frosting.
Oh, no. Oh. okay, good. I just had a note from Carol. She said, you know, I used to like her before she made me all hungry. This is just unconscionable.
And I'm snickering at that. I don't usually snicker.
You just moved on into giggling. Okay, I know. We see how you are.
I'm a step away from a slightly whiplash big laugh with then twirling my mustache.
Oh dear God! So that's the mid-afternoon snack. What's for dinner?
Well, I had dinner already. So I had the Mexican food. So I had a chicken flauta,
yeah.
and cheese enchilada combo plate. And today is Margarita Monday. So I had to have a margarita as well.
Well, of course it is, mm-hmm. And of course you did.
I mean, I don't get to drink that often, but when I do, and it was a even though it was a house margarita, it had a kick to it. Cause you
hey,
don't
no. Do not knock the house margarita, okay?
No.
You don't waste... You don't waste good tequila on margaritas. You just don't.
Mm-mm. No, it's a sin to like yeah, you know.
Randy,
do, yeah,
Randy,
you know.
Randy just said, "Well, there goes half the Horn Commune off to dinner." Yeah, and I'm about to be one of. Oh man, see, I've been battling my sweet tooth lately. I don't understand it. I don't know why it's happening. I try to be really good, but I've been on an ice cream Jones since we started talking about your homemade ice cream.
Yeah,
and Ferg and I walked into the DQ the other day, and
the Dairy Queen, yes. Remember, I'm from California. You gotta come on now.
Oh, okay. We walked into the 608 the other day, and. Ferg ordered an Elvis Blizzard.
What is the peanut butter, banana, and what else?
Chocolate.
But hey, that was good. That was a pretty good guess, right?
Yeah, well, peanut butter and banana is always an Elvis unless we're talking about shooting televisions. That's the TV Elvis. And you do that with the Elvis gun. Thank you very much. But I had a taste of that and whew. And I really try, Tracy. I generally like Breyer's ice cream, especially the vanilla, because it's just, you know, ice cream. It doesn't have any guar gum or locust bean gum or any. No. It's just milk
it's just
and cream,
ice cream
and vanilla and. Right. And so I tried their sugar free vanilla ice cream.
Why?
No. I tried their sugar-free Neapolitan, chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry together.
And?
Well, because I didn't want to test my sugar in the morning and have it be like, you know, Avogadro's goddamn number.
12,550?
Yeah, right. You know, it doesn't even give you a number. It just gives you a skull and crossbones on the screen. it was terrible. It was awful. I mean, maybe if that was the only ice cream I ate for the next 15 years, I might forget what ice cream tastes like.
With the cream
state. That was terrible.
You don't do that to yourself. It's just mean and just cruel. And I need this cake right here on the corner. I'm getting the lemon cake and a slice. There's not even slices. It would be rude to call it a slice. I think I should call it a chunk of cake.
No. Okay, no. Here in Appalachia, that's a hunk.
Yeah. Okay. Hunk. It's a hunk of cake.
Oh man! The food porn has come through. Oh, I'm talking about pictures on the radio. Oh, stop it. Oh, the crumb cakes. Damn.
Yeah, this place is Satan's workshop. I see now the little kitchen.
And those are just wait, those are just hunks of frosting.
I
know how you are. Yeah, there we are. There we go. Ron in Raleigh says, I'm heading to the kitchen to bake a Swiss chocolate cake with fudge icing. Damn, Tracy. Yeah. See what you do?
Oh, there you go. That's what I did. That was the laugh.
Jim wants to know if they have insulin while you wait in that bakery.
No, you just go into a diabetic coma and deal with it. Jim's the break. The absolute break. I shouldn't be doing this. If my doctor knew what I was doing, he'd kill me. He would put it. He would actually put a hit on me.
New word.
Yes,
yeah, okay. We've taken it a step further. That's a slab o cake.
Yeah, a slab. It's a slab of cake. It's a absolutely positive.
See, you got me. You got me wandering off down memory lane now, Tracy.
I know this is grandma.
I'm remembering the homemade chocolate icing that my mother would make. And you know what her secret was?
What?
Just a couple of wee tiny little drops of almond extract.
Yep. Not much, because
it'll overpower you.
Almond extract.
Yeah, it'll overpower it in a hurry. But just a couple of drops, and it just picked up all that chocolate and just launched it all over your taste buds.
Yep.
See, I've finally gotten to where I look a long time. I drink a lot of water. But I like a pop, soda, whatever, you know. I like a carbonated. I like a carbonated beverage from time to time, and I finally I can tolerate Diet Canada Dry ginger ale.
Okay, I can't do diet soda. I can. Hey. Speaking of carbonated beverages, I accidentally yesterday I was at 7-Eleven and wanted some Perrier. Don't judge. I wanted bubbles, but I didn't want calories. So I grabbed a bottle of Perrier. And I'm drinking. I'm like, wow, it has a kick to it. They have green apple enhanced Perrier.
Well, you know, even the purists would knuckle under sooner or later.
Mm-hmm. It was because it was fun because I wasn't expecting it. Because it was in a green bottle. I didn't notice that it had a green apple. I'm like, oh. Because, see, again, I need to be a water drinker. I don't like water. I need to drink more water. So any way I can force myself to drink water, that would be me. So that, you know, I'll do carbonated. Because the kids kill two birds with one stone. I'm drinking water, and I'm getting my physiozone.
There we go. Because
carbonated water makes the world a happy place if you got to drink water.
Okay, so I gotta ruin your day.
Oh God! Okay.
Fair is fair. I've always got something to come back with.
Okay.
Okay. Right. Okay. No. Wait a minute. Note coming from Philip in Maryland, and he seems to think this is my fault. Subject line: Have you no decency? There are diabetics, of which I am one, listening to your show, and I'm doubling the metformin and insulin in a sure-to-fail effort to control my sugar level during your obscene discussion with Tracy. Look, it's your show, and I don't advocate censorship, but damn it, Bob, can't you at least forewarn us when the conversation is going to center on all the foods we crave but can't eat? At least Tracy has an excuse. After all, she lives in a state in which the ocean is on the wrong side. Well, there. Oh, but no, it's my fault. I keep a mirror in the studio for crushing up metformins just to, you know, snort them. Right. Yeah, and there we go. Arthur said, I knew it. Tracy's just a Perrier drinking liberal.
Well, actually, I am a store brand drinking carbonated water liberal. I typically drink store brand, like, you know, Kroger. Which is our
Ralph's,
you know. Right. Oh, well, see, now I'm going to add, see, I'm not, even I can't be this cruel, but right, I'm parked, I've walked away from the bakery, and I am parked in front of this place with handcrafted Danish ice cream and vegan sorbets made fresh every day. I'm not going inside. I'm going to stay out here.
Wait, vegan sorbets? Okay. I was about to say, since when do we make ice cream with meat? But I wised up real quick before I embarrassed myself. There, all better.
So vegan sorbets made fresh every day.
I'll bet that's even tasty.
It's probably, well, you figure a vegan sorbet, only thing it is, because sorbet is, there's no dairy in sorbet anyway.
Yeah, so.
No, there isn't.
I'll bet it's gluten-free, too.
Yeah, so you got some, because there's this place that I went to the other day that I had a mango sorbet that made me want to weep. It was a combination. I did a threesome. I did mango sorbet, lemon sorbet, and coconut sorbet.
Wow.
It was a lemon lime sorbet. It brought a tear to my eye because it was wonderful. and it was refreshing, and I didn't feel like I was eating a shit ton of sugar. Because, again, I got to do something about my weight other than, you know, just mass-consuming food. But the stress of the move was killing me. So now that I'm happy, I have a sugar high going. I haven't eaten the cake yet. I will do you guys the favor of not actually eating the cake until we go eat, until Bob goes off air.
Because right, we don't want to hear you go,
moan and groan and, you know, stuff like that. So I will do you guys the favor of not doing that. I can be mean.
You are a person of real Christian decency.
I have my moments. So now I'm waiting for the payback because this is Moran Monday. So I know it's going to be good. See, I'm sitting down, and I'm good. So hit me with it. Hit me, baby, one more time.
Got it. Well, I am. I'm going. I'm scrolling down here. Wait a second. No, can't do it.
Oh, before I forget, did you get that text that I sent you about your wonderful state?
Oh, yeah. We're just flipping awesome here. We're going to drug test 4 people.
Mm-hmm. And I love the article, the Think Progress article, when they were talking about, well, why don't, if we're going to drug test people that are, because there was that one asshole that said, we should have to drug test people living off of the government's dollar. Well, then we should drug test the government employees as well, meaning our the people that we vote into office. Or better yet, stole their position from gerrymandering. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to ruin your evening now. Because it's my turn. So let's,
I have sugar.
So let's say you live in North Carolina.
So let's say that I don't, but... Okay, I will.
And let's say you're not even transgendered.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're straight.
Mm-hmm.
But let's also say you're black.
Okay.
And you've
you've got a
little daughter, little kid, child, baby. And you've got an appointment for her at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center.
This is not going to go well.
And you're just going there for, you know, your appointment. Because where and when your appointment.
Where do you go?
Right. I mean, that's, they've got a little pediatrics clinic there. And yeah. And it's Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center is a great big ass hospital, right?
Because it's, yeah.
And so they've got, and there are always these, like, retired white ladies who work as volunteers at the hospital. Still with me?
Oh, God. Okay. Maybe I should eat my cake now. But go ahead.
Yeah, Isaac turned me onto this over the weekend, and I passed it over to Agnes, who had a purple polka dotted blue screaming conniption.
I can't wait to meet Agnes.
If you want to just go ahead and get the hockey puck for this.
Actually, there's a hockey puck in Will's bag, so go ahead.
Okay, and you know that slab of cake is probably about the size, bigger than a hockey puck, isn't it?
Much bigger.
So, He started videoing when he had the interaction with the older white lady volunteer at the hospital, who just kind of kept on going, okay? And nobody can really sort out what it is she was upset about, but damn, she was upset. Stand by, please. Because it's more in Monday.
Lady, what is wrong with you? We need some help. There's something wrong with this volunteer. She's in here acting a fool. She's already calling me a nigger. And she's pushing your stuff out the door. Well, lady, what are you doing?
You're getting out.
You're getting out. You're going all over the internet. We ain't did nothing wrong to you.
Peacefully having a conversation while the kids were playing. I don't understand.
Shut your mouth up. I don't want to put up with you. I don't care what you say.
What's wrong with you?
Lady, what is wrong with
you? Shut up. What's wrong with you?
What is wrong with you, lady? I got a camera. They're going to see how you're acting.
I'm scared
because you're yelling at us.
You come up here and take these people out of here.
Oh, my God.
Are you on your medicine, man?
I'm not putting up with it.
What is wrong with you, lady?
You just worry about your camera.
Don't get help.
You just called the Jesus.
Don't put your hands on me. Get out of my face, lady.
Get out of mine. Get out of my face. Get out of mine. Get out of mine.
Don't put your hands.
Touch my son.
Don't put your hands on me. Don't touch my baby, lady.
You get him out.
Get your hands off of me, lady. Get your hands off of me, lady. Get off of me, lady. Get off of me. Get your hands off of me. Get out. I'm going to get my baby. Something's wrong with this lady, man.
Get your damn underwear out of here. Gray underwear. I can identify his damn underwear. Get his shit out of here.
Something is wrong with you, lady.
Something's wrong with you.
And you're going all over Facebook.
Children. Children. Are you a child?
Call them black children again. Call my baby. Call my black baby. Say what you
say. Get out. Get out.
These black babies out of here.
How old am I, you dumb?
Don't put your hands on me, lady.
How old am I?
Don't put your hands on me, lady.
How old am I?
Don't put your hands on me, lady. Don't put your hands on me, lady. What is wrong?
Dirty old tramp.
What is wrong with her, man?
They got some new with it.
What am I doing?
He didn't do anything.
Gray underwear.
Who cares?
I don't want to see it.
Okay, you
need to look at it. Y'all need to do something about this lady. There's something wrong with her. Okay. And then you're going to call my children black. Get these black kids out of here.
I don't care what
lady, you need to get out of here now. Get these black kids out of here. Bye.
Take your underwear.
Take my what? Say it again. Kick me, lady. Kick me and call me black again. Call me black. Call me a nigga again. It's something wrong with you, lady. On your own camera, I'm going to show this to your supervisor.
I'm trying to calm, diffuse the situation, okay?
That lady don't kick me and that man. I don't know what's wrong with her.
She's something wrong with her.
Something is seriously wrong with that lady.
Told you.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is, this video goes on for another 4.5 minutes. And she's up in the guy's face. I mean, you heard that shrieking. It was almost like being at a... Well, never mind. I'm not going to say it.
She sounded like the flying monkey from The Wizard of Oz.
But you know what I found telling out of this? You know, the guy, you know, doesn't lose his temper. He's just videoing her because, you know, you got to have evidence if you want to be believed, right? If you're, you know, black.
Right.
And she's just shrieking and the bit the underwear it's gray. You tramp, you dirty old tramp.
Why? Was she sagging? Not that it makes any difference, but what the fuck was going on with that stupid bitch?
But along the way, he says, you know, this lady needs some help. She needs help.
Yeah.
If the roles had been reversed, it would be this lady needs to be this lady needs to be tasered and pepper sprayed and probably shot a couple of times. Shoot some sense into her, officer. But oh my God. A spokesperson for Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center has said the woman is no longer a volunteer.
Oh, gee, well, there's that. She's no longer a volunteer.
Yeah, and this was in a children's clinic. She was a caregiver for children. Little, tiny, precious children were placed in her custody.
Little people.
And there's a couple of moments where the camera just sort of slides over to the children, and they're kind of like, what? This is why we can't have nice things.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Carol said, I slipped out of the room for a minute. Please tell me this is not Tracy ordering cake. No, Carol. No. This is just a nice, I had my cake.
I just haven't eaten it yet.
This is just a nice Christian white Baptist lady in North Carolina. Okay, maybe she's not a Baptist, but it's a Baptist hospital.
You know, she's a Methodist.
Yeah, she's probably...
Or evangelical. Because she...
You know what? I'd worry. Okay, it's North Carolina. I'd worry about that lady in a bathroom with my daughters.
Yeah.
A lot more than I would some trans person. I can see your underwear.
Oh my God.
Marty just writes in and says, so is she a Clinton or a Trump supporter? I'm betting she's a Trump, a Trumpy, but you know.
I think it was one of those things I was talking about the other day about North Carolina, because you know my mom lives in Vietnam, and of course my mom and I are not speaking. So, yeah, maybe the reason. I mean, it's kind of like me not being able to go to my not wanting to go to my sister's wedding and having surgery, so I can't go. It's along the same vein of me not having to go visit my mother because I'm not going to North Carolina ever.
And
I like North Carolina.
Yeah, but yeah, dear mom, you know, meet me in Massachusetts or something. Maryland.
Meet me in Maryland. I like this. It's a beautiful state to visit. And it's, you know, but I cannot in good conscience, like you were talking about the hot sauce. I cannot give my hard-earned money to a state that's going to be, you know, that just blatantly has discriminatory practices.
This is a serious question, Tracy. Should that conduct be deemed criminal?
I think it should be.
Now,
she was a step away from, I mean, I haven't seen the video, but she was, that was verbally abusive. And if she had had a chance, she probably would have assaulted the man.
Well, actually, she was committing assault. Okay, if North Carolina is anything like a lot of other jurisdictions, assault happens when you are put in fear of receiving an unconsented to touching of an insulting or provoking nature.
She did touch him. So that bitch needs to go to jail. Had it been me. I would have been in jail. I would have been tased in jail and probably hanging from a bar in my jail cell by now. Just saying.
Welcome to Merca.
And this is one of those things. These are those things that, you know, like, you know, I haven't been to North Carolina. I haven't been back east or North Carolina. Let's see. I guess it was, 2010? No. It was after me and Jan had been together. So maybe 2012, 2013. It's the last time I've actually, you know, been in your part of the country. And, you know, and the only reason is because of the fact that, you know, Jan and I were getting married and expenses for the wedding, blah, blah, blah. So we're like, you know what? We're going to, you know, slow our roll on, you know, the traveling thing. But now with this shit, you'll probably never see me in the South. Which is ridiculous because, again, I personally could not live in the South because, you know, my mouth, and because I'm black, and because I'm a woman, and I'm a lesbian, and mostly because of my mouth. So I couldn't.
You already said mouth once, but I understand.
I know, but really because of my mouth. I couldn't live down south. I couldn't. I know. I think I told you guys about the story when my mom and I were in Oklahoma City, and we stopped at a Shell station so we can get gasoline. And I'm walking out of the convenience store part of the gas station, and the rednecks pulled up in there, you know, big old 4x4 with the Confederate flag, you know, blah blah blah. And you know, in polite society, you allow the person who is walking out of the door or the elevator to exit first, and then you walk in. But of course, you know, as I'm walking out, I get the looks from the group of people that, you know, it's about four of them, and between the four of them, they maybe have three teeth between the four of them. And, you know, they're looking at me like, nigga, move. And I'm looking at them like, fuck you. But then I realized where I was. I was not in California. I was in Oklahoma City. And then my mother sat up and she's like, and my mother was pumping the gas. And she's like, she gave me that look like, don't say a word. And then it just that quickly, I realized that I could be killed. And I cannot interconscious live any place where I would have that fear. And this is before there was a jail in my life. This was just plain on Black Militant Tracy. This is straight Black Militant Tracy. So, and after, like I said, I split second, but I knew I could die right there. And nothing probably would have happened to the person that killed me, or assaulted me, or anything.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying to me. Now, fast forward 2016, with, you know, Tracy, who is now married to a Jewish woman. Really? Seriously? Like I said, I would come and visit, but I can't.
Yeah, I'm guessing you're not going to be attending the Magnolia Festival down to Jackson, Mosulpistan. No.
And one of my favorite places in the whole wide world is Orlando. Unfortunately, Orlando's in fucking Florida. I'm one of those people that would go to Disney World at least every other year. You know, I haven't been to Disney World since Trayvon Martin.
That's the magic damn kingdom, right?
Right. Because, and I have friends, you know, you need to come to Florida. I can't do it. I can't go to a state where it's legal to hunt and kill Black people under the guise of stand your motherfucking ground. I cannot and will not do it. And it kills me. But what kills me the most, it is killing the economy of these states. Because you're taking away money from hardworking folks. I'm not talking about Disney. They don't need another dime.
Well, but by the same token, when the governor of New York signs an executive order saying no state funds may be used to travel to North Carolina, you know, North Carolina says, well, that's just them damn Yankees waging economic war on us again, because, you know, that's what was the cause of the first war of Northern aggression. Slavery didn't have nothing to do with it, you understand?
No. It was because you were, you know, using people as free labor. And treating them like they were dogs, they were stock.
Yep, exactly. Yep. No, it's economic pressures that the Yankees have always been using to oppress us and our liberty down here. Sit, liberty, sit. Yeah, yeah. Well, Tracy, it sounds like you're back in the car.
Yes, I am. I am rolling on my way to the ice hockey rink, but I just. It's those same things when I listen to, like you just said, the Northern aggression. Well, I will keep... Well, see, I'm not from the North, but I'm from the West. So, you know, there's nothing but truth.
The recent unpleasantness.
You got to stop. You sound like Foghorn Leghorn.
I'm supposed to.
You know, I've noticed something. Have you noticed? Remember back... I don't know when this changed, but... it is no longer KFC. It is now back to Kentucky Fried Chicken. When did that happen?
Is it
okay to be from Kentucky? Yes. It is no longer called. We actually have commercials. That's right. You don't have television. We have commercials now with the Colonel back.
Oh, no. Those I've seen. With the guy from Saturday Night Live?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those commercials are almost as creepy as the Colonel was himself.
Mm-hmm.
And the Colonel was creepy.
Oh, was he really? Why am I not surprised?
Yeah.
Was he creepy like Walt Disney creepy?
No, he was creepy like can't keep his pants zipped creepy. Or buttoned back then. Maybe.
Buttoned.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, see, that's my problem. Again, so it's like, Well, it's those things that just slip by you, that they think are, people aren't paying attention, but then there's me. And I'm, this has been like the last, what, this started like, I guess, last year, because it shocked me. Because I haven't seen the Colonel Sanders in about 20 years. I can honestly say it's been about 20 years since I've seen a Colonel Sanders, you know, the actor playing Colonel Sanders. His finger looking good. And so I'm now, so it's no longer KFC, because, you know,
it's okay.
Now it's back to, it's yeah. okay.
You're
and
right.
It's okay to have, you know, a antebellum Colonel.
Yeah, that's Colonel. Colonel.
We got
to work on your cornpone accent, Tracy.
Yeah, well, see, what scares me is that I can slip into it every so often, and it's usually after I've been down south for a little while. And I guess because it's, you know, since my family is from the south, even though I'm like three generations removed from the south, as far as people living there. But, no, actually, I'm sorry, I lied. Two generations. Because my mother was born here. I was born here. My grandmother was born in Shreveport. And actually, shit, my dad was born in Jefferson City, Missouri. Did I do that? Or?
You said Missouri.
Jefferson City.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jefferson City, Missouri. So, you know, depending on what, so I'm really only like two generations removed from the South. So it's easy for me to kind of slip into it because, you know, listening to my grandparents, my great grandparents and whatnot and so forth. But it terrifies me. Absolutely positive. South. And what is capable. I mean, not that it's not capable out here, but again, I've never had to worry. I've never feared for my life because I'm black. I have never, ever once feared for my life living in California because I'm black.
And you just don't see a lot of those stories like the one we just went through.
No!
You don't see a lot of those coming out of California. I mean, some, I guess, once in a while.
I mean, not to say that it wouldn't happen and it couldn't happen and it doesn't happen. I'm not stupid. I'm a realist. If anything, I'm a realist. But the fact of the matter is the likelihood of it happening to me, considering where I gravitate to, you know, even in Orange County, where I've been spending more time, I've spent more time in the last, since October in dealing with Will, I've spent more time in Orange County than I have in my entire life. I kid you not. Because, you know, other than, you know, the occasional Disneyland and, you know, a taxi trip here and there to the, behind the orange curtain, I don't come out here because I know I'm over there. There's just certain things that I do not put myself into these positions, you know. And like I said, but even in Orange County, I would not even think that that would happen. Like I was sitting in Seal Beach, and you know, sitting on the patio at a beachside, you know, Mexican restaurant, drinking a margarita, being served by a white guy. And how you doing? It's a great day today. Take your time. We're not busy. Enjoy your meal and your drink. And I'm thinking, would that have happened? Could you imagine that in North Carolina? Me sitting having a, first of all, I would, you know, this woman lost her shit just for somebody trying to go in for an appointment. Did you imagine if she owned a restaurant? She's a fucking volunteer. Could you imagine if she owned a joint? She might have came out guns blazing.
No.
And see, this is why I can't, as much as I, you know, think, I know I could get more bang for my buck in North Carolina, but I'm not going to live in a state where they're basically, like you said, about the labor practices. That's my personal favorite is, like you said, they don't take Walmart. I love them. Not only do they not pay state income tax and all that, they get their roads built with local money.
Well, we can Tracy,
drive to the parking lot.
Just so you know, you can probably, you mentioned Jefferson City a minute ago. You can probably add Missouri to the list of places you don't really want to go.
See?
You remember the remember the story last week about the woman who went over to get something out of the vending machine there in Jackson, Mississippi, in the hospital, and wound up winging her baby in the face with her Freedom Protector because it fell, her purse fell on the floor and the gun just went off.
No.
Well, there was that. That's okay. The baby's going to live. She's just going to have a disfiguring wound on her face, and maybe they can just tattoo the word Wolverines over it.
Idiot.
Yeah.
Idiot.
So this didn't happen in a hospital. This is a story out of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It was apparently a lovely Saturday afternoon in Missouri. Okay, we're going to say Missouri. And Mama had a little free time. And instead of taking her two-year-old and saying, come on, honey, let's go down to the bakery and get some pineapple cake.
I'm sorry.
Mama decided that that would be a great time to get out her Freedom Protector and give it the once over. Give it a good cleaning, because you know you got to keep your Freedom Protector clean in case you have to protect freedom.
This is not going to end well.
This story kind of struck me because it takes place on Oriole Street in St. Louis, Missouri.
Oriole? As in Orioles of the bird?
The bird, yeah.
Okay.
And as it turns out, long, long, and long ago, when one of my dad's dearest buddies from here got out of the Second World War, he went to work for the power company in St. Louis, and they lived on Oriole Street. So I just kind of went, well, I'll be damned. But anyway, Mama was cleaning her Freedom Protector, and her little two-year-old boy surprised her, walked up behind her, and startled her. And when the little two-year-old startled her, she turned around
and shot the baby. So I have a question.
Wait,
there's more.
I mean, I don't want people going, oh, damn, she killed her own child. No, she shot the little fella through his hand. And he was transported to the hospital, and he's been treated according to the police. They didn't give his complete condition, but the police said the little fellow was stable, and they said that the matter remains under investigation.
What is to investigate? That's child endangerment.
Yeah. It's also child abuse. It's also reckless and negligent, and I'll bet you Missouri's got all kinds of criminal. Maybe that's why it's still investigation. They're trying to count up all the stuff they can charge her with. Or maybe they're afraid that the NRA will call them ugly names and say that they hate freedom. And if only she'd had Eddie Eagle there. But no, Eddie Eagle only says if you see a gun, go tell a grown-up. Well, he saw the gun, but it was in the grown-up's hand, and the grown-up plugged him.
I was going to say I've never handled a gun. That's a lie. I was in the service for a hot second. So I have shot, you know, a weapon. But I have a question. And I mean, this has been 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But don't you make sure that, yeah, I was in the Army, briefly. Again, my mouth. But don't you make sure, you shouldn't have, your weapon be clean? I mean, not clean, but no bullets in it before you clean your weapon?
Well, since when do you stand up? Tom the hell out. Since when are you standing up when you're cleaning your Freedom Protector? I mean, I used to clean Freedom Protectors, and I'd sit down, and I'd have a chamois there, and a table in front of me, and take it apart, and never mind. But who cleans the Freedom Protector standing up?
This is why, to see, you know, another reason why I don't have a gun, I won't carry a gun. I know my temper. And, you know, I find that the older I get, the less patience I have. So I know not to have a gun. I found myself the other day driving. I was pissed off. I didn't even realize I was driving while angry. I was And I didn't even realize it was so mad. I didn't even realize how fast I was driving until the CHP typically comes up beside me and says, "Taxi driver, slow down." And I was very fortunate because he didn't give me a ticket. I still really don't know how fast I was going, but I was definitely going over the speed limit. And I actually had a cool CHP driver that just got on his loudspeaker, scared the shit out of me, and told me to slow my fucking roll. And he's like, "There you go." And I did a thumbs up and thanking him to myself, thinking, "Oh my God, thank you for not giving me," which probably would have been, about a $400 or $500 ticket easily, if not more. But like I said, I have no idea how fast that was going. So yeah, so I got. And then I'm barely at Los Angeles, which is, 24/7 rush hour in the midst of when people do stupid shit. And there has been many times that I wish I had a gun so I could shoot somebody's tires out. Not gonna lie, I have felt that way. So this is why Mama Tracy don't own a gun. Because I know I would shoot somebody. I know I would. So, it's always good to know who you are and what you're capable of. But I guess never. Do you own a gun, Bob?
No, I do not.
Jay, I was talking some shit about getting a gun in the house. I said, "Really? Well, to protect us, protect us from what? I got a baseball bat and a 9-iron. I think we're good."
Oh, yeah. No. A mashie right upside. Four. Right.
Four. I'm good.
Hey, Tracy, I hate to say it, but
we gotta go.
We gotta get out of here, but it's been a lovely conversation. I'm sorry for ruining your cake.
No, honey, I haven't eaten my cake. Remember, I promised that I was going to eat the cake while I was listening to you. That would have been rude. So as soon as you sign off, I'm going to eat my cake.
You know what? Dairy Queen closes at 9, Tracy, and it's 3 minutes till 9, Tracy. The Wiggling Pig closes at 9, too, even if I wanted to knuckle under and get some sugar-free briars. Damn it.
Some bullshit at 9 o'clock. I know the reason to stay out of the shop. Okay, I love you very much.
See you, Tracy. Bye, dear.
Bye, darling.
Oh, goodness me. The lady cab driver, that's Tracy. A gentle reminder, there's a $100 challenge on the table that has been unresponded to. Looks like tomorrow's fundraising goal will be $800. Sorry for the doubling up this week, but can't be helped. Because we exist on a month-to-month basis. Oh, well. We'll see. Oh, shut up, Tim. Tim from L.A. Dairy Queen's still open here, Bob Kincaid. I am not going to drive all the way across the river to Kroger just because Tracy has got my sweet tooth screaming. And that's the second bakery store of the day, too. Chris in Germany got me started with a bakery store. Oh, bakeries in Germany, stop it. But anyway, so it's time to get out of here. Hopefully, we'll take a hunk out of that $800 hole, or the $400 or whatever. The $100 challenge getting met would be awfully helpful. Thank you, one and all. Have a wonderful evening. We'll be back for Titanic Tuesday tomorrow. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Peter Mattei as much as I did. Time to get out of here. Time to head over to Malloy. Y'all have a wonderful evening. Good night, y'all. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.